Let me, without any further ado, let's bring Connor on the line. Are you with us, Connor?
I am, Jake. What's up?
Hey, so today you wanted to talk about food freedom.
Yes, sir. Yeah, fewer topics perhaps are more impacting on the individual and the family than the right to consume the food that we want.
Well, and this is a very Utah type of issue, too, because how people do food storage and things of that nature.
Sure.
Here.
Yeah, in fact, you know, you've now got the federal government, the FBI, putting out these memos saying that potential terrorists, people, the behavior to watch for include storing a lot of food is now one of their suspected terrorist behavioral patterns, in addition to many other things as well that people commonly do on a regular basis.
So that's pretty much every devout Mormon.
Right. Well, and anyone with a bit of common sense, too. You want to buy when things are cheap, and then you can use it over time, and you can, you know, you're more prepared in the event of an emergency. But,
yeah,
but you know,
yes,
especially because of Utah, but any heavily agricultural state is going to face a similar issue where they have severe regulations, both within the state and also the federal government as well. But I was really intrigued by a story that came out just a couple days ago about a battle that's been going on with the Federal Department of Agriculture, the FDA, and an Amish farmer. This was a guy near the D.C. area, Washington, D.C., that was selling raw milk to willing consumers voluntarily. People really wanted it and loved it, and he was selling some of it interstate as well. And so that's what primarily got him on the radar of the feds. They did a sting operation. They went to this Amish guy's farm at 5 a.m. I think, if I recall correctly, these guys had guns drawn. This was 2 years ago. And they stole his products, and they shut him down. And they've been battling it through the courts, in which the Amish farmer won at a lower court level and was told that he would not have to pay the fine that the FDA was trying to impose upon him. The FDA appealed, and then the farmer now lost that case because of the interstate commerce clause empowering the federal government to be able to dictate what, you know, people can and cannot do. So this is an interesting story. It's pretty controversial because, I mean, you've got this peaceful Amish guy selling the natural product that comes out of a cow's udder to willing consumers who may happen to live in a different state. You know, what's the big deal? And this really all ties back to a very popular, though largely unknown by many people, Supreme Court case called Wickard v. Filburn. It was decided in 1941 by the Supreme Court, which at the time had been stacked with FDR's, you know, it's when he expanded the size of the Supreme Court. He stacked the deck with people who were very favorable to his status expansionist government policies. What had happened at the time was there was this law that was passed by Congress in 1938. It was called the Agricultural Adjustment Act. And this is central planning at its finest. They were, because of the Depression, they were trying to do price controls. So they were going down even to say that certain farmers could or could not grow certain crops in certain amounts. They were, especially wheat was the issue. They were worried about the fluctuations on the international market of wheat prices. So they were regulating what an individual farmer could and could not grow, how many acres, how many bushels. So there was this guy, I believe he lived in Ohio, with the last name Filburn, Roscoe Filburn. And he basically gave the middle finger to the feds and said, I'm going to grow what I want. He grew more than he was, you know, purportedly allowed under this 1938 law. And he was penalized. He was assessed a fine. He took it to court. And went all the way up to the Supreme Court, in which this FDR-friendly set of judges unanimously decided that he was in violation of the law, which they claimed was valid. And what's interesting is he was not selling, in this case, any wheat to anyone across state lines, unlike this Amish farmer was. He was simply keeping it all for his family, for his livestock, his animals. Nevertheless, the court unanimously reasoned that because of the constitutional clause which grants Congress the power over interstate commerce, these judges on the Supreme Court said that Congress therefore had the power to regulate the price at which commerce occurs because of this power to regulate commerce. So they said that Congress can do price fixing. And what's interesting is you say, well, he wasn't selling it across state lines, so how does that fall under federal authority? What these judges claimed was that, yes, okay, Filburn did not sell any wheat across any state lines. However, because he didn't, because he grew his own wheat and therefore did not have to buy any from the interstate or international market, that that type of action in the aggregate definitely affects interstate and foreign international commerce. Therefore, because of his actions, because those actions in the aggregate would affect interstate commerce, therefore we can regulate what the individual does. This was unanimously agreed upon by the court. It has been the bedrock of every usurpation and violation of anything commerce-related since 1941. Bills that we're dealing with here at the state level, the legislative attorneys will put a constitutional note on there very often and say, well, federal government, the Supreme Court would strike down this law as unconstitutional, or they likely would strike it down as unconstitutional because of Wickard v. Filburn and the, you know, power of Congress to regulate anything at the individual state or federal level. And so this has been a blatant violation of what the Commerce Clause was intended to be, and it's now just been this huge can of worms that we're having to deal with any bill that tries to impose a check upon the federal government, whether with this Amish farmer who, granted, was selling across state lines. That makes it a bit more tricky, even though that's a bad interpretation of the power to regulate, or rather to make regular interstate commerce. But even with things such as growing your own food, we had the Senate Bill 510 last year that was the big controversy, that the FDA's powers were greatly expanded. The federal government claims the authority to go in and stop people from growing their own medicinal marijuana, even when their state has legalized that within the state boundaries. The federal government still claims the authority under the Wickard decision 70 years ago to go in and penalize, prosecute, fine, to punish a person who is growing a naturally occurring plant because those behaviors in the aggregate would supposedly affect interstate commerce. This is something that pervades the entire justice system, and it all stems from this 1941 very poor Supreme Court case, which needs to be overturned.
Yeah, this is fascinating because this is really kind of like a boon for any libertarian analyst, because there are so many problems that this type of thing raises. Obviously, the bad stuff that the FDA does across the board. Now, one of the ones that this kind of pried from my memory is how the FDA is basically saying that stem cells are a drug, which would in effect say that your body, you don't own your body anymore, which, I mean, we could argue that the government's already kind of made that case in a few other ways, but this would say that you can't use your own stem cells to heal yourself, which is really crazy and overreaching. But it also speaks to some things, I think, that some themes that we've talked about, especially with your focus on the Constitution. It speaks to, precedent. You know, can we have judicial review and overturn these things? Or are we stuck once a law or an interpretation becomes precedent? And then specifically to that, interpretation. How FDR was able to stack this with a bunch of socialists, the judicial branch, and they just interpreted the Constitution any way they wanted to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think there are certainly better methods than others of fighting back against the federal government. I favor nullification rather than seeking judicial permission to exercise our rights, just exercising our rights. And then
taking it to court like this guy did.
You know, it'll eventually land up in court, but, you know, to not go and try and sue the federal government in their own courts, but to rather stand firm as a state and say, these are our rights, you cannot violate them.
Hold on, guys, come on back, Mental Self-Defense Radio. All right, guys, welcome back, Mental Self-Defense Radio. I am Jake Shannon. We are in the middle of the Boyack Review with Connor Boyack, talking about food freedom and the FDA. Connor, what the heck can we do? You touched on nullification. You teased it before the break.
Yeah, so I was saying before the break that I'm a favor of multiple approaches. I think some are more effective than others, such as, you know, nullification. But certainly if we can take it to court and win there and use existing systems to gain victories for liberty, then let's do it. There's a bill here in Utah. We've actually got a couple bills. There was a bill that we're running under Senator Anderson right now that is a food freedom bill that basically says anything grown in Utah, consumed in Utah, and only sold in Utah is not subject to federal jurisdiction, basically upholding the Constitution by saying that intrastate commerce was not given any constitutional authority to Congress. That remains within the state. in order to determine what laws, if any, will be passed in regards to that commerce.
So wait a minute. What's the name of that bill again? So if people do want to contact their local legislator, that they can get them behind it.
Yeah, so that one, the sponsor is Senator Anderson. It's Senate Bill 34, and it's titled Production and Sale of Food in Utah Revisions. Now, this is an interesting one real quick, that we have that bill, but there's also another one. And there's actually two different approaches that each of these bills take. The one that Senator Anderson is supporting deals explicitly with commerce. And as we've been working, what we're finding is that there's been significant opposition from some of the bureaucracies and groups here in Utah to that bill, because it is such a bold bill by saying that any agricultural-related commerce that stays within the state is exempt from the federal government. There's a lot of tentacles, you know, of kind of incestuous, you know, activities between the federal and state government where they overlap so significantly that causes a lot of concern to the entities that are tasked with enforcing the state and the federal laws. So there's actually a different bill that's sponsored by Representative Herod. This bill is House Bill 198. It's one that was ran last year, though slightly different. It's simply called Growing of Food, and it is past the committee level already. And all it simply says, it's a very short bill. Rather than dealing with commerce, it deals with family food only. So basically, rather than saying that, you know, you own a farmer's market and you only sell to people in the state, therefore you don't have to deal with any FDA or USDA or EPA rules and regulations, what this instead says is that if you grow food on your property for your and your family's consumption, then you're free from those same type of rules. So it's not so much a commerce angle as it is an individual, a family, food freedom angle that's much more easy to get support from these entities that get a bit nervous when you start, you know, bleeding outwards to all forms of agricultural commerce. So we're finding that this bill stands a much better chance at passing. What's nice about this bill is it's so common sense. I mean, who's going to stand up in the legislature, although there certainly have been and will be some who do, that says that, you know, the federal government should have the right to regulate what you and your garden are growing. And so it stands a lot better chance at passing. Now, what happens if this passes, it provides a fertile ground upon which to defend the law against any suit by the federal government. So, for example, if I'm growing anything in my backyard that the federal government thinks that they should be able to regulate, they take me to court. That provides an opportunity to really try and overturn Wicker v. Filburn. So the two approaches. We can have this really bold bill that's going to cause a lot of problems. It's probably going to have to get watered down through compromise. There's a lot of opposition to it, and it, you know, probably will get smacked down pretty easy. Or we can have this much more simple approach that Representative Herod's doing that's going to get a lot of easy support from other people because of its simplicity and obviousness. And if this goes to court, it stands a really good chance at taking on Wickard v. Filburn by simply saying, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous to have the federal government claim the constitutional authority over the food that I grow in my backyard for myself and my family. And the implications of that are astonishing. If the federal government does mount a challenge to this law, if it becomes a law, and if it goes to the courts and if we overturn it, we're able to then, through that awful precedent practice that's done, get that changed for all the other states. So rather than having a bill that just deals with Utah, if we're able to agitate through the court system and get Wickard v. Filburn overturned by the same horrible Supreme Court entity that once put it in place 70 years ago, that frees up the avenue for all the other states to likewise reject any federal oversight over things done within their state, not only for agriculture, but any commerce at all. So it's a very has very high potential. We'd probably have to wait for the feds to sue us if that were to happen. There's lots of other options. I don't claim to know Representative Herod's full intentions and hopes for his bill, but as I stand on the sideline and in limited discussions I've had on his bill, I see much more hope and that possibility for what that can do for the long-term cause of liberty as it relates to restoring the true intention of the Commerce Clause in the Constitution.
Yeah, that would be Utah's doing some interesting things, and Utah's got kind of a bit of a split personality, it seems like, when it comes to liberty, because we've got some great bills like this going through the process, and then we've had like the Sound Money Act actually pass. We've had some good things. But I was also seeing in the Salt Lake Tribune that new professor up at UVU, he's a free market type, Randy Simmons, and he has this whole article, Utah's Declining Economic Freedom. I don't know if you saw about it, this article. I'd recommend anybody check it out. He's a professor of political economy up at U- oh, I'm sorry, it's Utah State University, not UVU. Mm-hmm. But we have a bit of a split personality. I mean, wouldn't you agree with that? I mean, I think you probably more than most might be aware of that given the nature of the book that you put out.
Yeah, I often label it much kind of what you're talking about, but I give it the term inconsistency. There are people who, they oppose the federal government, especially on doing this, that, and the other, and yet they're totally okay with the state doing the same. So it is very much a split personality, both along the federal and state lines, but even, and maybe this is where you were going, that even within the state, it's people who will claim to support liberty for one thing, but they have no consistent application of liberty to other subjects, especially as it relates to maybe alcohol, for example.
Well, and that is another thing that's going on. Representative Butterfield, is that his name?
Yeah, uh-huh.
So tell people a little bit about that. I know that that's – is that in committee now or what's going on?
It actually passed committee just late last week. That is House Bill 140, and it is titled Vehicle Checkpoint Amendments. This is a bill which would repeal the authority for police within the state to conduct sobriety checkpoints. DUI checkpoints, as they're more commonly called.
So basically, to just stop you, if you're driving from A to B and you've given no cause, but they stop you anyway.
Yeah, and it's argued under two different pretenses. Representative Butterfield more likes to support his bill by arguing that those checkpoints are ineffective, that actual drunk driving is better deterred by having the police on the roads and looking out for people rather than just this whole, you know, high press showman, hey, we're going to be here doing a checkpoint between the hours of 2 and
yeah.
You know, or 7
yeah,
to 10.
Yeah, and like any drunk person couldn't just take an alternate route or something.
Exactly, or get drunk the next day when they're not there anymore.
Right.
So there's that argument, which is the more practical argument, or there's the constitutional argument, which says that the Fourth Amendment right to be free from search and seizure, to be secure in your property, person, and effects, means that they cannot detain, stop, question, search you without probable cause, reasonable suspicion, a judicially signed warrant. Interestingly, in Article 1 of the Utah Constitution, that Fourth Amendment text is copied almost verbatim. In fact, all the words are there. They just have some more modernized punctuation to it. So we often talk about the Fourth Amendment, but Utah's own constitution supposedly guarantees the exact same protections and freedoms to be secure in your person, papers, and effects. So
it's almost like we're just trying to get back what's already ours in the first place, that protection.
Yeah, and so his bill came out of committee. It's now going to go to the floor, where we'll see what chance it stands on the House floor, and then from there it goes to the Senate, where there's much less favorable of a chance. The old guard of the Senate likes to smack down things like these, but it's very favorable that this came out of the committee, and so now we'll see what the floor does.
Yeah, it's rather unfortunate, and I don't know if you saw. I know that you've been on Judge Napolitano's show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And did you see that clip that was on his show before it got canceled, sadly, talking about that Utah guy who was shot, I think it was in Ogden somewhere, during one of these SWAT drug raids, and he was, like, in his underpants holding a golf club because he was scared. He thought somebody was breaking into his house. They didn't read him rights. They didn't tell him to freeze, nothing. They just shot him dead. Did you see that?
I did see that. In fact, I wrote an op-ed about a week after this last incident happened. Matthew Stewart up in Ogden shot, six officers. One was killed. Very well known now in Utah that happened very recently. And my op-ed basically said, these guys made the news last week with this tragic incident, but many people don't recall that 1 year ago, it was the same strike force in Ogden. They were serving a warrant, which in this case a year ago was a no-knock warrant. They simply invaded the home of a person when, as it later turned out, they knew that the person they were looking for was not there. The person with the golf club that you mentioned was a roommate who was completely shocked by this sudden invasion of his home and out of self-defense grabbed the only thing he could find, thinking that, he was about to be intact, rightly so, which was a golf club. And the officers claimed that they feared for their life. They saw this shiny object and thought it might have been a samurai sword, and they put 3 bullets in him and dropped him dead.
And has there been any follow-up? I haven't heard. I've I tried to look any follow-up on this, and I've heard nothing.
As often happens with this case, the police investigate themselves. And they look into it, and they say, oh, what we did was exactly what we were supposed to do. I don't recall if anyone was given any reprimand, but if there was any punishment, to my recollection, it was just a very, you know, slap on the wrist, if anything. I don't recall specifically.
So not only is nobody going to do jail time for murder, but nobody even lost a job or anything like that.
Well, and it's especially unfortunate. Those type of things are happening almost 100 times a day throughout America. Those types of invasions into people's homes, especially serving drug warrants. So, you know, whether we talk about the Commerce Clause like we were towards the beginning or whether we're talking about, you know, police actions within the state, the concern here is that liberty demands a consistent application. So many people are willing to say, well, the Constitution says this, therefore the federal government should only do X, Y, and Z, but then when they take it down to the state level, they think that under the constitutional system that the Tenth Amendment says that states can do everything the federal government can do. That's wrong. It's that the rights, the powers not delegated to the federal government under the Constitution are retained to the states and to the people. To the extent that the people cannot or have not delegated an authority, a power, to the state government, then the state can't do it. People, including, I've heard Mike Lee, I think wrongly, argue this at times, that states have what are called, what's called plenary power, that they can basically do anything that they're not prohibited from doing by the Constitution. And that is an extremely dangerous interpretation of the rule of law and of the morality of law, where the government derives its authority. The state cannot simply do anything it wants, because if it has not been properly delegated the authority by we the people, by individuals, it cannot legitimately act on that power.
So we've got about 2 minutes, Connor. I want you to, if you don't mind, I want you to review those bills so that people can actually support them. Call up your local reps. All of them, from not only Butterfield, but the other two that you had mentioned, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so HB 140, House Bill 140, is the sobriety checkpoint one sponsored by Representative Butterfield. It's especially important to contact your legislator in the House of Representatives, because that's next where it's going to be heard. So that's House Bill 140 to get rid of DUI checkpoints. The other one is Senator Anderson's food bill that deals with commerce. That is Senate Bill 34. And then perhaps more importantly, because it stands a better chance of success, is also in the House of Representatives. It's Representative Herod's bill titled Growing of Food, and that's House Bill 198. And that has also passed committee, so that will be soon debated and voted upon on the floor. So we've got, again, a couple good bills. Each year we have some good bills coming out. Unfortunately, it's with a deluge of bad bills, and so hopefully over the years we can increase the number of good bills to offset the tyranny that we have at the state level. But these are some good bills that we should all support. So exactly as you said to all of your callers, please contact your legislators, encourage them to support it, and in the future sponsor similar bills, because this is a movement. We're getting more legislators helping us to sponsor and pass these good bills. We just need to make sure we get some better people there in the legislature to help us move the cause forward.
Yeah, this is very important to actually take part and do what I call slacktivism. Just pick up a phone and call your legislators and support these things. This is very basic and simple to do, and it's a simple thing to do to get some liberty back in your life. Connor, thank you so much. The Boyack Review, great as always.